This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Richard Burton. He's the founder and publisher of Infinite Ideas, which is an independent press in England. Richard is not the actor. I'm sure everyone says something about that to you when they first meet you, which got to be pretty boring for you at this point.
It's either the actor or the celebrated Victorian explorer.
Right.
And translator.
Where have you been lately? Mr. Burton. It's really good to talk to you through the miracle of Skype. You know, you and I have known each other a long time through publishing principally. And what I wanted to talk to you about today is, you know, kind of your background, how you got to be involved in publishing, and then, you know, a little bit about what that might look like today and where we might be going. So maybe you could talk. I know your background is academic, originally.
Yeah.
And so maybe you could talk a little bit about how you became a book publisher.
Well, yes, I was doing a PhD in the early poetry of W.B. Yeats, and it took me a little longer to complete than the funding that I had available, which was 3 years. It took me about 5 years to complete the thesis. And so I sold my car and became a heavy goods driver. Not sure what you call it over there, but over here we have had an HGV Class 1 license, which allowed you to drive the biggest vehicles on the road. So for 2 years, 3 years, I was an agency driver, and I worked for many of the bigger brands in what has now become logistics, and I quite enjoyed it. It rubbed some of the academic corners off me, and I was quite happy doing it for the most part. But I realized that I needed more of a career than driving heavy goods vehicles was going to give me. So I looked around for a job in publishing, and as it happens, that a chap called Philip Cogan, who is still with us, I'm pleased to say, he rang me. I wrote to him because I knew that he'd just bought a freight guide, an ABC freight guide, and he had a small transport list, including the Transport Manager's Handbook, which I think has now gone into 45 editions. So I wrote to him, and I skewed all my letters towards the list of the publishers that I wrote to. Philip rang me, and he kept me on the phone, and I didn't really quite understand why he was asking so many questions on the phone. And towards the end, I discovered that he was basically interviewing me for selling space in the ABC Freight Guide, selling advertising space on the phone. I had a car, and I went out to haulage firms to try to get them to advertise in the in what was then the ABC Freight Guide. So I got my first break in publishing, not for having a fairly glittering academic career. I went to Oxford University and I did my PhD in London, and not because of that, but because I could speak what is known here as transport gaff. I knew how to speak to lorry drivers because that's what I did. So, for instance, when I left a book in a book on deconstruction, which I was reading at the time, in a transport cafe somewhere in the middle of England, and one of the truck drivers asked me if I was studying a foreign language. It was quite a good experience for a callow, you know, I was in my early 20s and I was heading for an academic career. Anyway, I got this break in selling space, and I was actually quite good at it, quite good at selling space, and I earned a reasonable amount of money. But I was quickly taken off the space sales job and put by Philip into his editorial department. And I started editing business books. I'm publishing business books. I was a commissioning editor for the Kogan Page business list, and so that's how I started. Business books has been a pretty big part of my career, one way or another.
So you went from Kogan Page. Did you also go to Blackwell at one point?
Yes, I did. I went to Blackwell Publishing, which is now part of Wiley, and I think I started there as senior commissioning editor for their professional business program. They didn't have one, and they wanted one, and they were a bit confused about, because basically they were an academic publisher, and they were a bit confused about whether it was trade or professional or monographs, and they weren't quite sure what they wanted me to do. Anyway, I did what I needed to do there. I'm concentrated mainly on professional, and then it went quite academic. It went into textbooks and monographs, mainly textbooks, and it was at Blackwell that I first learned about the American market, and I was publishing with a good colleague, Rolf Janke, some reasonable selling, some which are still in print in 6th, 7th, 8th editions, textbooks for the American market primarily. And then I left in the mid-90s to start my own business with a friend of mine.
Right, with Mark Allen.
With Mark.
And that was Capstone, which is not to be confused with the American publisher of the same name.
Correct.
But you were Capstone, you were in Oxford, I think, if I remember.
Yes, we were, yes.
And you set out to do a kind of innovative publishing at that time in the 90s. Maybe you could talk about what you were trying to accomplish there.
Well, we were trying to publish you perhaps don't remember, perhaps you do. Business publishing was pretty stodgy, and by the early 90s, and we felt that we could do something different by publishing the sort of books that wouldn't necessarily get through an editorial meeting at a big publisher, and giving them very, very classy designs and doing a lot of innovative marketing. We actually worked hard on marketing our books, and we did pretty well. For a tiny publisher, we punched well above our weight. In the UK, the biggest retailer of business books at that time was W.H. Smith Travel. And for perhaps a year, we were W.H. Smith Travel's number one supplier of business books. And for a startup, that was pretty impressive. And we got bought, Capstone was bought in 2000 by Wiley. And which was great for us. And we both went into Wiley. Both Mark and I went into Wiley, and it was just before they bought Wiley bought Hungry Minds, with all those great brands like the Dummy series and Betty Crocker's cookbooks and From Us Travel Guides, and many of which have fallen by the wayside since. But at the time, they were serious publishing brands, and Capstone was slightly dwarfed by this massive acquisition of Hungry Minds. But even so, it continued to do quite well under Wiley. And I've got a great fondness for Wiley as a business, because I think it's just very human. And it's, in spite of its size now, because it gobbled up Blackwell as well, it's a very human business, I think.
Maybe that's because it retained elements of its family roots longer than many other larger publishers and other big companies have done.
I think that's right. I mean, the first person to send me an email or to send me any sort of message when I said that I was leaving to start a new business was Peter Wiley, and I've never forgotten that. It was a very genuine, warm message of thanks for what you've done, and we wish you the best. And there was, it was very, you know, very quick to do it. And that, it was a symbol of the way that business was run. In fact, Mark, my partner at Capstone, went off to run the Asian business at Wiley, based in Singapore for a while. And then he came back here. Then he became chief executive of Wiley globally. And he's only recently left Wiley, I suppose in the last month or so. But he certainly has changed a lot of the way the business is run, but not so much the culture. I mean, the culture didn't need changing. It was always great, and still is, I think.
Yeah, which I think is markedly unusual. As companies grow, cultures change.
That's probably no
new news here, but I think it's important to notice when a culture does retain its personality, its warmth, its level of human scale.
Yeah.
I think that does make a huge difference. You know, as someone who's, since you've been a business book publisher, these are kinds of principles of business management that you've probably published books about.
I think I've countless business books I've been responsible for over the decades, but doubtless there are a few cultural issues addressed in some of them. But I think you're right about the family influence having been retained, and I think that's why Wiley is such a great place to work. I mean, I wouldn't be giving anything away by saying that there are people at Wiley who perhaps don't think it's such a great place as it was because it has got bigger, and it's 20 times the size it was when we joined it, and it's a very big business, and I'm proud of Mark for having guided it strategically as well as accepting the fact that it's still a family business, you know, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, well, and it's very. Yeah. I think it's so difficult for any publisher today, at any level, at any size. It's the challenges of publishing are substantial.
Yes,
and for any company, you have to reinvent yourself continuously.
Yeah,
which is that's a challenge. You know, it requires lots of attention and is very different from the kind of classical notion of what publishing once was,
that's right.
And I'm not saying that it was better then or worse now or any of those more or less trite things, but just that you can observe that 30 or 40 years ago, publishers thought of themselves very differently than they do today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think the publishers that have survived the vicissitudes of the economy and the global economy and the meltdown of the global distribution model in publishing have been able to have actively embraced change, and that's another cultural issue in business. But it's easier to say than to actually do, and I think those publishers that have done it are a better place to cope with the future and the continuous change that we're seeing than many of the more sclerotic publishing businesses have gone to the wall, of course, but there are still some surviving because of their scale that are both a little bit sclerotic and still survive, still able to, because of their size, continue to publish. But I do think generally, and particularly in the independent sector, that publishers have had to think very differently about the way that they, or the ways that they approach consumers.
That's a perfect segue for us to talk about Infinite Ideas, which is your latest iteration of what a publisher can be.
Yeah.
And so what year did you, I know this, but I want you to talk about,
sure,
when you founded Infinite Ideas, what you were setting out to do.
Well, we founded Infinite Ideas in, I think it was 2004. And I learned a lot because I was running the Dummies program in Europe for Wiley when I was there on an earnout after the Capstone acquisition, and I looked at the Dummies list and I thought, well, if we were starting from scratch, knowing what we know now, would we have this model? And I came out with some pretty clear answers that no, we wouldn't do certain things. And so we started out as a self-help publisher. And I'm rather ashamed to say that we didn't really understand the effect that the internet was going to have. And it could, because nowadays, if you start coughing in April, you don't go into your local bookshop to buy a book on allergies. You go online and you say, coughing, and you Google coughing in April, and you come up with a lot cheaper answer than buying a book, possibly even better. But we had some aspects of the business that were I think unique. We owned, for instance, all our content. We had writers rather than authors as such. We paid them a fee, and then they kind of walked away from it because they weren't celebrities. We weren't selling the content on the author's name. We were selling the content because it was good content about all sorts of issues, sports and health and relationships, and all, we had a comprehensive series of about 60 to no, well, probably with the spin-offs more like 120 books. And they did quite well. They did very well for a period. But then the internet took over, and we realized that our sales were falling. So we had to change tack. And we retreated into, when the recession, what turned out to be a global recession, turned out in 2008, 2009, we retreated into our heartland, which was business publishing, because business publishing, as I was taught by Philip Kogan very early on, is almost recession-proof. So, the business community wants a different type of book during a downturn, but they still want content. They still want information about how best to turn businesses around to avoid running out of cash. They might not be so interested in big cultural issues but they're more focused on survival than growth, perhaps. So in that sense, we rode out the recession on the strength of our business publishing. But and business publishing did come back. I mean, after a while, because so many business books were bought in airports and in travel outlets generally, and that stopped for a while. Because nobody was traveling, partly because of 9/11, but partly because there weren't the budgets for it. But then business publishing started to come back, and we were quick to get back into it. And we've done that for we're still doing it. We're still, I imagine that 30 or 40% of our income is derived from business publishing, one way or the other. But recently, we've decided to take the wine publishing industry a bit more seriously. So we did a book on port maybe 5 years ago, and it was a one off, and we did it almost as a business book because there were two businesses in particular that were willing to support this particular book. So we did a few more that were again sponsored by drinks companies or distributors, and we realized that they were, some of these books were doing quite well outside the sponsorship, so we put some investment in it, and we've now published 9 books. We're publishing another 7 in the second half of this year. We've got about 20 contracts for the next 2 years. In fact, I would imagine that we'll end up at around 40 or 50 titles in about 3 years' time. And it's quite an interesting market, actually, because pretty much everyone else in the world has pulled out of professional wine publishing. And there might be a very good reason for that. it might be that it's not a great place to be. But so far, we've done pretty well with it. We've done some global promotions that have been successful. But it's still a challenge. It's still breaking into a new subject is as hard as it ever was, perhaps harder, because you don't, we don't get the support from the book trade that we used to. These are fairly expensive books. They're professional books. And we sell them direct to consumers. We don't sell them to, you know, so much to the intermediary.
Well, that's something I think that's really interesting to talk about. I think for me in particular, it's a subject I'm interested in and have been for a while, which is how can publishers, in the face of, I wouldn't call it the collapse, but certainly a change, radical change in the way books are sold has had this, the effect of reducing shelf space. And while Amazon is very important, it's still a single point for purchase, and its rise means less display. You know, you're all of your books are available all the time, but they're really hard to find.
That's right.
So when publishers think about selling direct to consumer, I think many feel uncomfortable, unwilling, and perhaps unable to wrestle with it. And clearly you don't feel that way. So without giving away any trade secrets, particularly if you don't want to, maybe you could talk a little bit about how, how does a publisher construct a business that includes direct to consumer while still including other channels?
Yeah. Yeah. When you said earlier, that you wouldn't say collapse, I think collapse is the right sort of, is the right term for certain kinds of books. So our books, which are, you know, typically our wine books, but are typically £30 or $40, they're too specialist and too expensive for what is still the book trade globally. I think. For that type of book, the sort of book that used to get some support from, well, not support, but it used to get some distribution through the conventional book trade, I think that has collapsed. I think that's gone almost completely. But so have the returns. So if you look at the returns rate that we had 10 years ago, it was pretty significant, and now we have none because it's pretty much all. Customer orders.
Right. In other words, you're talking about trade sales where returns, traditionally when you are selling to booksellers, you know, your returns rate would have been 20-30% as a norm for trade book publishing. And so what you're saying is now, which makes sense, if books are being ordered for a sale, there's no prospective purchasing on the part of a retailer. They're not buying books to put on display and then what doesn't sell, send back.
Yeah, that's right. It's exactly right. And the publisher has to take that hit for 6 months or whatever it is of having effectively very few sales or much lower sales than they expected. So it's, there is a cash implication, when we realized that effectively we were borrowing money from the book trade, and it wasn't really a very sensible way of doing business. It wasn't for our type of books anyway, but it was difficult to take that hit for a few months. But now we, you know, when we look at it, the difference between our returns rate now and what it was 5 years ago, when it was, you know, 26 or 27%, and it's quite comforting to know that we're not getting that level of stock back. And of course, the technology has made holding stock less necessary, improved print technology has certainly helped that model.
So does that mean...
So we don't have much inventory, no.
So are you printing... Well, I was going to ask about that. Can you say the print runs... Do you print a smaller number initially and then replenish using digital printing technology?
Exactly.
Do you replenish in quantities. In other words, like if you start with 1,000, then print 200, 200, 200, like that? Is that?
Yeah, or less, or fewer, rather. If we start with 1,000, it's typically we'll print 50 or 60 and just keep reprinting. I mean, it's more expensive. You've got a higher unit cost, of course, right. But you've got no inventory and no returns and guaranteed guaranteed buyers. It's a different model from the one that we're used to, but it's not a bad once you get used to it. You know, there's some real compensations, but it does put the onus back on the publisher to, or more of the onus on the publisher to find consumers, because they're going into bookstores less frequently. They're looking for people look for content, I think, online, and if it's convenient to buy from their local bookstore, then they will. And if it's not, or it's cheaper, or whatever, for whatever reason, if it's more convenient elsewhere, then we'll go elsewhere. So the key for us is finding those people and delivering information to them that they want, where they want it. You know, and it's all about that, rather than about sending reps to bookstore hubs in the hope that we'll get a scale out across a nationwide scale out for a book, you know, a lot of which comes back. So so that's what we're doing. We're trying to target target is probably the wrong word, but we're trying to encourage business from those people who really want our books and make it easy for them to find them. And we're doing promotions with brands that are trusted within the community that we're interested. So in the case of wine, for instance, we do a lot of promotions with the Wine Spirits Education Trust and the Institute of Sommeliers. And the Institute of Masters of Wine, and so on. So these are brands that are already trusted in the community that like our books. So the brands they wouldn't help us promote our books or our content if they didn't like it. So I think it's a question of really for us, it's a question of building the database of consumers that like our content and increasing our promotional activity with third parties.
Right. And it's clearly where the implication is that the specialization in a subject that has high value supports fairly high prices, I would presume.
Yeah.
And repeat customers, so that, you know, it's necessary to specialize. So you couldn't be a general trade publisher doing books in a myriad of subjects and have this model work as well. In other words, you have to, the idea of having repeat customers means that you go into a space and try to become the number one.
That's right.
Or number two at worst, you know, kind of, you want to be the key supplier of high value information. You become a recognized, trusted brand. And so it makes sense for you. That kind of explains, you know, why it would make sense for you to publish 20, 40, 60, 100 books on wine and spirits, then you can take advantage of your expertise and your brand to build a relationship with actual consumers, which is unusual for, you know, that's where I think publishers, and I think for years publishers have said the brand is not the publisher, the brand is the author.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore publishers are kind of houses of brands, not brands themselves.
That's right.
And you are changing that. I think that's the, you know, kind of the key point there is, or the key takeaway is that you are in fact, and you were well positioned to do this because the way that Infinite Ideas was constructed at the beginning, I think you were trying to make the publisher the brand from the outset.
Exactly. In the way that Dummies was probably and still is, I suppose, although less potent than it used to be. It's a brand in itself, and we wanted to do that with Infinite Ideas, and I think we've got better chance with wine than we have with self-help, for obvious reasons. But I think the other thing is that wine is if you're interested in sherry. And you're really interested in sherry, then $40 for a book on it is probably your weekly or almost daily consumption. You know what I mean? These are people who are used to spending a fair bit of money on bottles of wine, and even the students are different because to be a student in the world of wine, if you want to be a master of wine or you want a WSET qualification or you want to be a sommelier, which is a very, very well paid fashionable career these days, then you're not doing marketing 101 at a university somewhere. You're probably pretty well heeled already. So it's not even the students are different as well as the I suppose you call them professionals. Yeah. And serious consumers. You know, when I say serious consumers, I mean I don't mean that they consume a vast amount of sherry. I mean that the sherry that they consume is serious sherry. It's not ordinary blended stuff. It's sherry from well-known growers usually. And pretty reasonably high price as well.
I would think a side benefit of this for you is you get to go visit some fairly interesting places.
I've had some fantastic tips for buying wine fairly cheaply. That is three or four, tastes like wine that's four or five times the price normally. So I certainly have. Improve my consumption of wine, if nothing else.
Right, but have you been invited to any place, any exotic vineyards for tours and things like that?
Yes, I have, and we don't typically go on them because it doesn't sell books, that's for sure. What is interesting is that some producers, wine producers around the world have bought bulk copies of books on their region.
So, right.
For instance, we did a book on the wines of really what is a tiny village or surrounding hamlets called Faugère in southwest France, and the Faugère region really got behind it and bought a lot and sold a lot of this book, and for a while. For a good 3-4 months, it was easily the bestseller in our wine list, and we thought it was such a tiny region that it was not almost not viable. But in fact, it's about gauging the energy and the commercialism in a particular region rather than anything else. So rather than its size. So for instance. Burgundy is a big wine region, a lot bigger than Faugère, but there are lots of books on Burgundy, and it doesn't need to be dramatic in its promotion of itself as say Austria, which had a very big PR problem stemming from the scandal of. Antifreeze that was put in Austrian wine in the 80s, and then they've never really recovered. So they bought thousands of copies of our book on Austrian wine because it presents a very good, presents the professional face of Austrian wine production. And so I think it's not as obvious as the subjects that we pick for our books are not as obvious as you think they are. You know, the Faugère book really, the success of the Faugère book last year really, made us sit and think about, what do we really want to do a book on Champagne or which is huge, or do we want a book on Tokaj, which is not so huge. Right. But, you know, because there is that institutional government support likely to come from it, from Tokai, that won't come from Champagne, because they don't need to. You know.
Right, which is, in a sense, an extension of the principle that you specialize, take that down to the next level, which is to publish well in underserved markets, which have the ability to support your publishing.
That's right.
So, I mean, you're kind of following that, you know, a kind of guide created for you by the way the market is shaped.
No, I think that's exactly right. So for instance, one example is the effect that climate change has had on English wine production. So now sparkling English wine is obviously nothing like champagne, but it is beginning to worry Champenois, because and champagne growers are buying land to grow to make wine in England, because it's become so much better than it was 5-10 years ago. It's the same with Canadian wine. Not very fashionable, I don't know what it's like in North America, but certainly in the rest of the world, it's not really, you know, Canadian wine is not yet, you know, making a big impact. But they produce ice wines that people love or hate. But what we've forgotten is the fact that they're producing in Canada extraordinary quality of table wine, which is increasing in leaps and bounds in export terms, and also in domestic consumption. And if you're spotting those trends, because the Canadian wine growers and the Canadian wine authorities are very keen to support anything that helps exports in particular. So I think for us it's about following. It's about being a bit cuter than just publishing books on Bordeaux and the wines of California, and hoping for the best.
Well, it does actually sound like you figured something out, and I think
that, well, I don't know about that.
Well, no, but I think that's actually good.
Yeah.
For you. Now, do you still have an interest in publishing in business books and, you know, the occasional literary book?
Well, yes, we still do some business publishing, but as I say, it's got to be the sort of business publishing where we can get to anything that's reliant on the trade is a disaster for us. So our best-selling business book for the last 2 years has got the comfortingly arcane title of ISO 2015, and then it's some acronym following a colon. So it's not the most interesting book in the world, but it's one of those books that people have to, if you're in the quality management function, you need to have this book. So inevitably it's done well at a reasonably high price, but not through the trade. It's always right. It's done well through not through the conventional trade anyway. So we still do that sort of book, and we have occasionally done literary books. We've done a couple of biographies, and that's partly because, you know, partly because of my particular interest, but you know, all those books have done reasonably well. I don't think any of them have made a loss so far. And I wrote a book myself on about a British poet called Basil Bunting, who was a modernist writer, and that goes back. My interest in that particular subject goes back, you know, 40 years, when I was at first at university, and the poet was still alive at that stage, and I felt that it needed a proper biography to help reestablish the reputation of Bunting, who was a phenomenon in the 60s and 70s, but has rapidly fallen away from public view. So we published that, and that is a bit more difficult. So I helped to sort of subsidize that slightly myself, which is which is OneWeb doing it.
Yeah, probably today, unfortunately, for many books, I think the subsidy is to make sure, you know, it's the way that we express our love for a subject.
Exactly. A subsidy helps the publisher make the right decision.
That's you know what I mean? Yes. In fact, I think that is clear.
Yeah.
Well, I really want to thank you, Richard, for talking to me. This has been really, really excellent.
Oh, it's been a pleasure, David.
This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about books and the publishing industry. I've been talking to Richard Burton, publisher, founder, editor, and sommelier of Infinite Ideas. Really great. Thank you.